You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. You know, Don, I think we're going to get back to average this week.
Back to average, yes. We are having normal weather. What's normal? You're right. Average is a better term. Lois and I are doing this broadcast on August 27th. Excuse me, recording this broadcast on August 27th. Going to be played on the air August 28th. And as we do this morning, it's 75 degrees and quite breezy here in Northern California. I'm looking out my window at a good, strong Delta breeze coming in and making us all feel very comfortable. We're only going up to a high today of 90, which is just like 1 degree below average for this time of year. Tonight will be 56 degrees and clear. Thursday, we do have the start of a warming trend, although again, they've been backing off a little bit on the absolute temperatures for our part of the valley. Day of the broadcast, 94 degrees and sunny. Thursday night, 56 degrees and clear. Friday, 94 degrees and sunny. Friday night, 59 degrees and clear. Saturday, hot. 97. Saturday night, 61. Sunday, hot, 96. Sunday night, 60. Labor Day, Monday, 92 degrees. Monday night, 57 degrees. And Tuesday, back to below average with a high temperature about 88 degrees. And of course, no rain in the forecast. Although yesterday, there were some interesting weather phenomena around California and our adjoining states as this big push of monsoon air from the Gulf came pushing up into California and went up the east side of the state. Thunderstorms, lightning, all kinds of stuff. One of my staff people was standing in the doorway at our nursery in the late morning and suddenly saw, without a cloud in the sky over us, big flash of lightning far off to the north. And I heard the thunder several seconds later. I don't know what your grandfather taught you. Mine taught me it's 1 mile per second. So we figured that lightning was 8 or 10 miles away. And of course, anyone going up into the mountains for Labor Day weekend, check the weather before you go, because they are having some turbulent weather up there. We're going to have lovely weather here, and it's great planting weather, and that's good because it's time to plant brassicas, as we told you last week, and people are gradually making that shift, but it's still sunny enough, warm enough, and dry enough for us to get several more weeks of fruit production out of our summer vegetables. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from folks like you to cover our operating costs, keep us on the air. There we go. So if you like what you hear, if you like the Davis Garden Show, if you like Jazz After Dark, if you like That's Life or any of the other 35 plus locally produced radio programs, then just head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And I do want to mention
you're talking about all those wonderful shows we have. We have a producer who's retiring. I can't believe it. Clyde Bowman is not going to be doing the connections.
K-Dirt alert that after 10 years of sharing the music of Davis-grown artists with an international KDRT audience, Clyde Bowman, a.k.a. Connections Clyde, is hanging up his broadcast headset for good. So you can tune in for Clyde's final farewell fiasco, complete with surprise guests Looney Tunes and Donuts. That's Monday, September 1 at 3 p.m. And remember, music shows are on the air or on the website for 2 weeks after they broadcast, so you can go check it out afterwards. That's right here on KDRT 95.7 FM in Davis with a worldwide audience at KDRT.org. We are going to miss you, Clyde, and thank you very much for 10 years of great programming, bringing local Davis musicians to the world.
And the title of that show is Davis Music Connections. So head on over to the station's website and check it out.
We got lots of things to talk about. We've always
Andrew sends us an email and says, ahem, A-H-E-M, ahem. And defines it. It gives us a dictionary definition, an interjection representing a slight cough or clearing of the throat, used A, to attract attention, especially prior to speaking, or B, to express hesitation, disapproval, or suggestiveness. Okay. In response to your recent malignment of the noble Brussels sprout, please take cognizance of the attached recipe for delicious Brussels sprouts, sans boiling, and therefore no malodorous sulfur. Quite serviceable to guests who will be astonished. They will demand more and praise you endlessly.
Yeah, so this is
Early,
a great...
Culinarily yours, Andrew and Cynthia. And he attaches the recipe.
Yes, it's for tasty Brussels sprouts or cauliflower, which I guess can be used interchangeably, from Café Beaujolais Cookbook by Margaret S. Fox and John Baer. I note that they grate the Brussels sprouts in this recipe, which is a good way to disguise Brussels sprouts when you're cooking them. Your guests will never even know they're eating Brussels sprouts. I don't want you folks to think I'm negative about Brussels sprouts. I actually like them very much, but it was a funny thing in our family that we're pretty evenly divided in this regard. My parents, my mother and father, father loved them, mother wouldn't even cook them. When my children were toddlers, we would do a thing of handing a freshly cleaned and ready to cook raw Brussels sprout to each child. One child, one bite, the facial expression was priceless, clearly was not going to be a fan of Brussels sprouts, at least not raw. Other kid ate it like an apple, just sat there and munched on it like it was the best thing we'd ever handed him. Kid also liked rutabaga and turnips and all kinds of offbeat vegetables. So people are variable with respect to their tolerance for the sulfurous odor when cooking, and the bitter content that Brussels sprouts and all the brassicas do have to some degree. This is one where you grate them, you crumble them, you mix them with butter and salt and white pepper and lemon juice and parmesan and walnuts. That all sounds great. And then you saute them, and you mix it all together, and then you steam them and taste. And if it's too crunchy, you just steam them a little bit longer and you cook them for a whopping 2 minutes and top with the parmesan cheese and the walnuts. So it's a real simple recipe. They're not overcooked. I think my mother's other objection to Brussels sprouts was that she grew up with a mother who was from Boston. Boston
oh.
cooks, no offense to any of you that are, Boston cooks are some of the best cooks in the world. My grandmother's biscuits and fried chicken and all that were unbelievable, but all vegetables were cooked to death. All vegetables
mush.
at least 20 minutes, seemingly 2 or 3 hours sometimes. My grandmother would take fresh peas that she would purchase from a door-to-door vendor, and then she would cook them until you could mash them with a fork. Why would you do that? That's heresy. But that was the way she cooked things. And so if you don't like asparagus or Brussels sprouts or broccoli, there's one possibility. You've had them only overcooked in the past. I don't want undercooked Brussels sprouts, but they are still a little tender, and actually have a little give when you spring back a little bit when you bite them rather than just being mush. You might appreciate them more. I'm not sure where that came from in the Boston School of Cooking, but I have the Fanny Farmer Cookbook, which is like the original Boston Cooking School Cookbook. All vegetables are cooked to death. I don't know why. Maybe it's to sterilize them. Who knows? But definitely there are some that do not take that well. Asparagus and Brussels sprouts among them. Thank you for the recipe, Andrew. I will definitely try it.
The other, it said, or cauliflower. The other thing with cauliflower is my husband makes the most wonderful cauliflower soup.
Sure.
And he roasts it and gets it all crunchy and stuff. And then when it's done, he blends it up with a whole bunch of stuff, and it's really good.
So talking about brassicas briefly, because we have mentioned this is the time to start planting them, what they actually want in your garden is a full sun location. That's real important. Sun all day is necessary for the brassicas that you're where you're growing a head or a flower bud or a stem or something like that. A little bit of shade is okay for kale, collards, where it's just the leaf that you're eating. But the ones where you're growing a plant that's going to make a flower bud or an inflorescence, which is usually what we're eating, you need full sun. They do like enriched soil. They definitely respond well to having the soil amended or at least mulched with some kind of enriched compost, some kind of fertilizer early in the growth cycle makes a big difference. When you buy them, look closely at the plants you're buying. This is a frustrating thing for those of us who are retailers. We're supposed to bring them in now. We're supposed to have them, but nobody's buying them because it's still summer. So they sit there. And this is, whenever I walk into a hardware store or a chain like that, I would immediately make a beeline over to the garden section. Of course I do. And see what they're selling and see what the condition of the plants is. And that very commonly, I hate to say this, there's a lot of plants here that should just be thrown out. They're sitting there because they didn't sell. And if they've turned purple and they're just not putting on new growth, they just don't look healthy, don't buy them. I will take those personally. Split them up, when they get overgrown at my own store, and transplant them up to a 4-inch pot or a quart pot in enriched soil. And they really take off when you do that. So, just as with the advice we give you in the beginning of the summer vegetable season, keep them moving root wise, keep them moving to the next container. Six packs are fine. And this is one of the few types of vegetables you're still going to find in six packs in garden centers because that's how they're mostly sold, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, things like that. But that's a little tiny 2-inch by 2-inch root zone. And if it's more than a week to 10 days in that little six pack, it's root bound. It's okay if you then nurture it along a bit, but if you just take these overgrown, purplish, obviously not thrifty, as they like to say in the UK, not thrifty specimens, and plant them out in your garden, they're going to take a couple of weeks to really get going. So I do recommend looking for new healthy plants if you possibly can. Find out what day your garden center gets deliveries on and go check them out that day. In our case, it's Fridays. Okay. So that would be the day for fresh stock. If you do get one that's kind of overgrown, it is worth it. Just as with the summer vegetables, to give them a second step in a enriched soil in a 4-inch or quart pot, or even a gallon can if you're so inclined, because that'll get the plant growing vigorously. If you don't have time for that or the inclination for that, go ahead and turn in something into their root zone. We don't do this often, but in this case, it really can make a big difference that has nutrients in it. We sell a bagged potting soil that's so enriched that people are using it for that purpose. They'll just take it's our 420 blend, which you can guess what that's for. It's got bat guano and seabird guano and chicken manure in it. One little scoop of that turned in for each plant will make a huge difference in getting them going. Get them growing well. You need as big and robust a plant as you can get before we get into the very short days of winter. That way, you'll get better results. And I will say, of the brassicas, they're really on a spectrum with how easy or difficult they are to grow. Easiest, kale, collards, stick them in the ground, harvest right away if you want. You really don't have to do much of anything to those. You're not growing a head, you're just growing leaves. You might want to wait and let them grow a little faster than you're picking them, but other than that, they're all pretty straightforward. Easy, in my opinion, broccoli, and particularly the sprouting broccolis that have become kind of popular, which is where you're just using part of it. You're not necessarily waiting for a big head to form. Broccoli, broccoli rabe, Asper Brock, any of that crowd, quite easy and very few pest problems. Cauliflower, well, it's just basically like broccoli. I've always had worse problems with aphids on it. And I've always had a problem with slugs getting into the head, which is gross when it happens. So that's something to be aware of. The cauliflower is a little fussier. If it's too hot when it's developing, the surface can get damaged. If we get freezing weather when it's developing, the surface of the head can get damaged. You can still use it, but it's kind of unsightly. So it's a little trickier to grow cauliflower just because of the added pest issue and the slight weather sensitivity. Cabbage in general, pretty easy. It just takes a long time. And then you got Brussels sprouts, which do need to get in early. They are prone to aphids and they take a long time to develop. So, on the spectrum, if you wanted to stick things in and not have to worry about them, hey, kales, collards are just insanely easy. And I would say broccoli is pretty much in that category. I've experimented for you folks. I've done things like planting 36 kale, collards, and broccoli rabe plants in one oak barrel. Works great as long as you keep them harvested so that one doesn't crowd out all the others. On the other hand, I also grow Romanesco cauliflower, which is that one that's got the Fibonacci pattern to the inflorescence. Beautiful, fascinating plant. Each plant takes 3 feet of space, right, to produce one head. So if you've got a small garden, just plant one for fun. This isn't something you're going to want to, devote a large area to. You're going to give 3 feet of space to a plant that's going to give you one head of essentially cauliflower in late February, early March. Probably not the most space efficient thing you can do, but it can work. On the other hand, all those leafy ones, you can crowd them together, harvest carefully, and you can keep that mix of leafy greens and brassicas and whatnot going right on through the winter. It is too early, really, to plant lettuce. People have been asking already. It'll get bitter, it'll try and flower. So we hold off on those till perhaps as we get closer to October.
So Sarah writes, a colleague of mine is an avid listener and suggested that I reach out. I have a healthy Western redbud that is fairly well established, 6 years in the ground and about 12 feet tall. This year, something is eating a lovely lacy pattern into the leaves. Under this tree sits my herb garden with oregano, thyme, mint, marjoram, sage, and basil. Do I need to be concerned about these caterpillars spreading to my other plants? And she sends a picture of, oh, yuck.
Just caterpillars. But this is the red-humped caterpillar, a name that will become very obvious within just a few days as to why it's called red-humped caterpillar. We have them on, let's see, red buds, cherries, walnuts. I'm trying to think of other things I've seen them on. You'll find a mass of eggs all in one place on the underside of a leaf. They all hatch at the same time, which is interesting. And then they start feeding locally. So the first thing you see if you're looking closely is a leaf that's become lacy, that has been, they've eaten between the veins, but they can't eat the vein itself. So that's the stage we're at right now. As we know, caterpillars are very hungry. There's a whole book on that subject. The Very Hungry Caterpillar. All of us have read this to children at one time or another. What do they do with their life? They basically spend it eating. And they start fanning out from where they all hatch the same day. And they pretty quickly get big enough to not just eat between the veins, but they can start eating the veins. And it's amazing how fast the foliage can disappear on a tree where you have an infestation of red-humped caterpillar. Because as you can see in that picture, there's what, probably about 30 eggs right there that all hatched at the same time, maybe more than that. And they're very, very hungry and they eat a lot of stuff. I tend to notice them on my farm, on young walnut trees in particular, when I see significant bird activity, the jays or the mockingbirds squawking down at the end of the field. And I go down there and find, well, there were red-humped caterpillars, but that problem solved itself. They definitely like to feed on them. But they can do a lot of damage quickly, especially to a young plant like a Western redbud. They'd be eating a lot of the foliage there. So the simple thing you can do, this is a great picture. You could pick that leaf and kill all of them very simply. You could just put them in a bag and put them in the trash. Or you could take that leaf and carry it far away from your redbud tree and just throw it on the ground. And hate to say this, they'll probably starve to death. They won't crawl back to the redbud tree. We have a few generations each year. UCANR has a great article on this subject. They've got, you just look up ucanr.edu and look up red-humped caterpillar, and you can see a picture of the caterpillar, a picture of the leaves, a picture of the damage they do, and a picture of the rather boring moth that they turn into. Once again, if this was a pretty butterfly, we'd be happy about it, but they're just a drab, boring moth. So we don't get excited. It's almost never necessary to spray for this. By the time you see the damage, they're well into their life cycle. They'll be pupating soon. Yeah, you'll get another generation at some point. I've seen them as late as late September, early October, but rarely do they do enough damage to any of the other trees I mentioned, like walnuts and cherries, to merit taking any action. On a redbud, I'd pick off that leaf and dispose of them, just mechanically remove them. If it's not practical, or if you're getting a lot of them, the BT sprays, an organic spray that is selective for caterpillars, will do a very good job on them. It works better when they're younger, so the sooner you can spray it in their life cycle, the better. Doesn't harm anything else. Good news, nope. They're not going to go down onto your herb plants, to the best of my knowledge. I've only ever seen these on woody plants, shrubs, and trees, in particular, the three that I've mentioned. Let me take a quick look and see if there's any other host plants listed here. Oh, plum, sure. Liquid amber. We don't see a lot of those around here. And you can find them on almond, apple, apricot, birch, cherry, cottonwood. There you go. Pear, prune, redbud, willow, and other deciduous trees and shrubs. Highest populations in California are in the Central Valley, as we can attest. 3 to 4 generations typically is what we've dealt with. And as I say, mechanical removal, I think, is your best approach here. But you could spray with a very safe organic spray if that's something you choose to do. Don't be surprised if this problem solves itself. If you've got jays or mockingbirds coming into your garden, they definitely like these. So they might take care of the problem. Now, put out a bird bath and see if that takes care of it. What would you put out for food to draw in a I think we've had this conversation. Mockingbirds?
Mockingbirds eat things in your yard. You
Okay.
don't put out food. They don't come to a feeder.
Okay, how about jays?
Well, they like peanuts, but I
Okay.
mean, if they're in your yard, they're in your yard, and if they're not, they're not.
Yeah, they're territorial, and you pretty much know when you have either mockingbirds or jays out there. But
Oh, yes.
my experience is that they do a quick number on these. They take them off very quickly. But it is surprising how much damage a group of, 30 or 40 caterpillars can do in their short lifespan.
So the picture she sent is of a very of one leaf, and redbud leaves aren't that big. So these things are really tiny at this point. If you don't notice it right away and they've gotten bigger, will spraying it with a hose with water, will that do anything? You said they couldn't crawl back to the tree if they were on the ground.
Correct. Yeah, that would probably work to a degree. Yeah, just putting them out where they're more exposed. That's the other thing. All kinds of things feed on caterpillars. I mean, if they're on the ground crawling along, found a place to curl up at night, I guarantee possums and skunks and whatnot will probably feed on them as well. They're a great source of food for all kinds of things. Yeah, spraying them off would be one thing you could consider. But in this particular case, they're all in one spot and it's easy to see where they are. So even if they've spread further down the branch. So, for example, when I'd have them on my walnut, they could do a lot of damage to one whole 3 or 4 foot shoot of growth, but I can prune that out if I'm so inclined. I'll tell you, I've never bothered because in an orchard setting, the problem solves itself. But I
Well,
can.
in an orchard setting, you've got jays. I
Oh,
guarantee
yes.
it. I
Yes.
guarantee that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in the backyard, you probably do. But it's just amazing how much they can eat in a short period of time. Red humped caterpillar.
So Don frequently sends me pictures, and today he sent me a wonderful three-up shot. And what it is he picked tomatoes when they were not ripe. And so I'm looking at the tomatoes on the left-hand picture, and some of them are have a little touch of pink on them. Most of them are green or yellow, not definitely not ripe. And then he has a picture in the middle of those exact same tomatoes sitting on the same towel on the same counter in the same positions, and you can see which ones have gotten riper. And the ones that were picked when they were reddish are now ripe. But the ones that were picked when they were pinkish are right, that they're looking pretty good. And the really yellow green ones, that they're coming along. And then the third picture is ripe tomatoes. They're
Yeah.
almost all. I think there's only three in there that I would hold on to a little longer. How much difference in time is this from when you pick them to the last
So
picture?
the first picture was taken 7 days before the second picture. So it was a week apart. I'm beginning to recommend this more and more to people for a variety of situations. It came up with a question in a Facebook group about sun scald on tomatoes, sunburn. We finally had some hot weather last week. We finally had some high temperatures. And so we got sunburn on some fruit. And it was an early girl. Early girl has a fairly open leaf canopy and the fruit was burning. Clear picture of sun scald. Well, to avoid sun scald on tomato varieties, there's several things you can do. But one of the main things is if we're about to have a heat wave, they're telling us it can be 2, 3 days, 100 degrees plus, and you've got some fruit that's exposed to the direct afternoon sun and is close to ripening, the wax seed protection on the fruit is beginning to thin out and is likelier to sunburn. Just pick it. Pick it ahead of time. You can pick a tomato once it's gone to breaker stage, which is lighter green than unripe, just beginning to turn color, and it will ripen in about 10 days. You can wait till it's another 2 or 3 days on the vine, getting more towards light yellow, which is when I usually pick them in this situation, and it'll take about 7 days to ripen on your counter. It varies depending on temperature and other factors. But if you get them before they're really getting to pink, orange, or red, in my case, I was doing it because the turkeys were walking through the garden and pecking at whatever fruit they could reach. And they would only peck the ones that were beginning to turn color because they could see them, I guess. So I would just start picking those ahead of them. And that was what was going on here. I've dealt with the turkey problem separately by cross fencing, but this is how I got all those fruit away from that kind of damage. But sun scald is the same thing. Pick them ahead of time, let them sit on your counter. This also gives you a chance to try certain varieties that may be new to you. At different stages, because I have found modern hybrids, for example, turn red before they're fully soft ripe. That's considered a desirable characteristic to the plant breeders. It turns bright red before it's really at its peak of ripeness. Champion is a good example. Very good tomato, but if you pick it when it's just bright red, it's really 3 to 4 days away from being as sweet as you might like it. So you might try some of these varieties. If you're going, well, that one was too tart, I don't like that variety, pick another one, let it sit on the counter, squeeze it gently each day. When it starts to give, try it then. I suspect you'll find that the sugar content is higher, the acidity has dropped somewhat, and you'll find the flavor is more to your liking. So it can avoid problems from pests. It can avoid problems from tree squirrels and tree rats by picking before they eat them. It can avoid problems from sun scald. And so this is something that I think a lot of people would be less frustrated if they didn't try to fully vine ripen their tomatoes all the way to the point of being soft. I've been finding it really handy because they just sit here on the counter and those 3 or 5 or 7 or whatever are ripe. I can use them right now. The others are continuing to ripen. I had someone say, well, doesn't that mean you don't get the full depth of flavor because you haven't allowed them to ripen on the vine? I guarantee the flavor will be very, very good. Yes, this is how commercial tomatoes are grown that have given tomatoes such a bad rap, is that they pick them green, and I mean just off green, and then they gas them with ethylene, and they manage the CO2 and the temperature, and they ripen them, and they send them to the market. They're bland, inedible things. But there's a lot of reasons for that that have to do with the way they're doing that. They're hastening the ripening with the ethylene gas. They're basically trying to get a bright red tomato that can be sliced and put in your burger from Burger King. They don't care what it tastes like. That's not what's going to happen when you do this at home. You will get a very rich, flavorful tomato, and you can let it go practically soft, ripe until it's almost falling apart. But you'll have more control over that than you do starting in, say, August or September with the tomatoes that are out on the vine, where you go out, you're pulling tomatoes, and some of them are sort of falling apart because they got soft and overripe. I think this is really a way a lot of gardeners can manage some of the pest problems that are coming their way, and also sun scald. Now, a couple other things about sunburn. Don't prune the plants. Keep the foliage as dense as possible. Many tomato plants shade their fruit very well. Early girl, fairly open growth habit, so it can be a little vulnerable. Celebrity is pretty vulnerable, but a lot of other tomatoes have better density. If you don't prune them, don't do that thinning thing that you read about where you take them down to just 2 stems, et cetera, et cetera. That exposes the fruit more, so that'd be less desirable here in the valley. So maintain dense foliage. Caging, putting them in a cage rather than just a single stake. And you just keep pushing the branches back into the cage until you essentially have a 6-foot tube of dense foliage. That will increase foliage density and protect the fruit. There's places where you're listening that are more humid where that would not be as desirable because it would trap moisture on the inside of the plant, might lead to leaf diseases. But here in the arid West, we can cage them and get greater density, protect the fruit from sunburn. Watering deeply. Sun scald is often associated with drought stress. If the plant is drought stressed, one of the things that happens is that waxy coating on the fruit thins more rapidly. So it's more vulnerable to drought stress. Yes, you can shade the plants. In my opinion, that's, you know, sort of a last desperate measure. The more you shade it, the less fruit you're going to get overall, but it may protect individual fruit. A panel of shade cloth, the simple way to do this, just a couple of stakes to the west of the plant, 35 to 50% shade cloth stapled onto that to shade it from, let's say, 3 o'clock on. That can protect any exposed fruit on the west side. So that's something you can do that won't reduce yield because you're not shading the plant overall. You're just protecting the fruit from the direct rays at the hottest time of day. And then finally, harvest early. And also make notes for yourself, which ones have thinner foliage. Celebrity and Early Girl are two examples of fairly thin open growth habit. So the fruit's more vulnerable to sunburn. If you've got one that's really dense, make note of it and keep that in mind for your own purposes. Some of you have gardens where you really can't minimize that afternoon sun. I happen to have my vegetable garden now where it's shaded from about 5 o'clock on, which makes a big difference for the plants and also for my comfort out there. Some of you are in full western sun, so a little shading might be helpful, looking for varieties with a denser growth habit and picking the fruit as it's turning to yellow and letting it ripen on the counter.
So Don, you sent me an article that you've got on your website called Fragrant Foliage.
Yep.
What's all that about?
I sent that to you because I have a customer slash listener slash friend who is having vision issues. And we were chatting about that. And I was reminded that many years ago, and I see with this article in front of me, October 2008, I wrote an article for the Davis Enterprise about a garden that was created by a customer then who was blind. He was completely without sight. He was also an avid gardener and I've had more than one. And so we were chatting about what you do when perhaps your vision is struggling, or you're going into a different phase of your life, to make your garden a pleasant place to go. Well, what he did was he focused on plants with fragrant foliage. And I told this listener that I would mention some of those plants that we could figure out ways to get them going. This one gentleman couldn't see the plants in his yard, but he could touch them and smell them. So you can find this article at redwoodbarn.com. It's called Fragrant Foliage from October 23rd, 2008. What he used, first we were chatting about, fragrant shrubs and things like that. And I said, well, right now, because it is happening, near my front door, my night blooming jessamine is blooming. It's a bit much, let me tell you. And this person had also experienced that plant. Then there's sweet olive, osmanthus fragrans, another one, powerfully fragrant. There's things like star jasmine, there's true jasmine, there's all these plants with flower fragrance, but they're a little overpowering sometimes. And most of them, by the way, are evening scented or night scented, which is not a time you're going to be walking around your garden as much. So they wouldn't be my focus in the garden like this one. What he had was he allowed me to go out and take pictures of his garden. You'll see pictures of the path and the benches and things like that. He put in a crushed pea gravel path that was a couple feet wide. That has some advantages. It naturally stays kind of level because even if some of it gets knocked out of place, it'll just sort of fill back in. So it makes a safe path, crushed pea gravel. At my nursery, we've also used livestock bedding, just the livestock shavings, and spread them out over crushed pea gravel, which was our original path. And that was safe enough to walk on as well. So this is an important consideration. He also put in here and there just stakes, just a stake with a that was something that someone walking by with reduced vision could just reach out and touch so they knew exactly where they were and that they were following the path correctly. And I think that's important at some sort of a stake. And then just started buying every spring. He'd come in and buy scented geraniums. That was the particular group of plants that he really liked. He especially liked the peppermint scented geranium. Take a pause here. Those of you in frost-free zones, that one can go crazy. Okay. But here it dies back. So wherever you're listening, you may have to adjust these recommendations to your own situation. He really liked that one. It has a fuzzy leaf and smells like peppermint. And in La Jolla, my plant climbed up at a 6-foot fence and over onto the other side and ran all over the place. Here it gets 3 to 4 feet across, freezes back. He cut it back. Sometimes it even dies. So he'd come back in and order new ones. But he just liked having these types of fragrant leaf plants spilling into the path or growing next to the path. So, for example, lemon verbena, which I have planted in every vegetable garden I've had right at the end. Lemon verbena, you walk by, you just grab it, crush a leaf, it smells like citronella, strong citronella content. The flowers attract beneficials, so that's nice. It's a shrub, but it's got an informal growth habit, so it's likely to sort of lean into the path a little bit. So you'll brush by it as you go by. So it's one of my favorites for this kind of thing. The scented geraniums, he was particularly fond of the peppermint scented one, but there's rose scented. There's actually probably 15 or 20 different scented geraniums, with some with very strong, almost astringent smell, others with very sweet smell. But you need to crush them or brush against them or pick a leaf and smell it, and that's the way you're going to get the fragrance. So it's not going to be like that night scented jasmine or the osmanthus, where it's just fragrance drifting all over the place. You're going to intentionally smell this, so it's not going to overwhelm you.
Chocolate. It has chocolate. Chocolate.
Yes, that's a funny one that we'll talk about, a chocolate scented plant. There are some plants that there's a cosmos that has a chocolate scent. There's a geranium that has this scent. It only smells like chocolate if you say that to someone, the power of suggestion being what it is. You wouldn't smell that and go, oh, chocolate. But if someone says, here, smell this chocolate cosmos, you'll go, huh, smells like chocolate. It's funny how readily we can do that. Curry plant is a good example. There's two plants called curry plant, one that's actually used in curry, and the other one that smells like curry. I'm talking about one that smells like curry. It's a helichrysum. It's related to straw flower, Helichrysum italicum. It looks like a little lavender, basically, same kind of grayish leaf, compact growth habit. It smells just like curry powder and it smells wonderful. And on a hot day, it will actually volatilize. And even a few feet away, you'll smell it. More typically, you brush as you're walking by, and all of a sudden, you smell curry. So for him, I had recommended a handful of plants. I've mentioned lemon verbena, Agastache, the anise hyssop, which has got a wonderful licorice scent. There's a bunch of new varieties on the market, very much attractive to hummingbirds. New hybrids have a more compact growth habit. The old plants are more of a background plant. So this Agastache, lavenders, Many lavenders, of course, are known for the fragrant flowers, but many of them have fragrant foliage. In particular, the hybrid that was being sold by the Arboretum as one of the Arboretum All-Stars, Goodwin Creek, the foliage is as fragrant as the blooms. And so that's a nice one to have near a path. Give it enough room. You know, this is something where we would need to work together to make sure you're not planting things that are going to become a hazard on the path. But if everything's 2 to 3 feet from the edge of the path, you should be fine. I'm going to mention mint. I love mint. I think mint's a great thing to have running all over your yard, but I want you to understand that most mint will run all over your yard. So he used it a little bit. I've used it some on my property, but in a smaller yard, you know, they can really get away from you. So use with caution, be aware of that. But the other two or three that I really think will work in almost any setting, rosemary. Rosemary, particularly Tuscan blue, has a very spicy pine-like scent. Of course, the flowers are spectacular and they bloom in the winter, and there's all kinds of birds and bees and whatnot that love lavender, or excuse me, rosemary plants, and they're tough as can be and they get big. Tuscan blue in particular gets 4 to 5 feet tall. So that would be down on perhaps one end of the path with at least 3 to 4 feet from the edge of the path to give it room to spread, and you won't have to be pruning it all the time. And then, as we mention almost any time we're talking about any group of shrubs, plants for hummingbirds, herbaceous perennials, the genus Salvia is your friend for much of this, ranging from the common kitchen sage or the pineapple sage. That was one of his favorites, the Salvia elegans. That one's tender, so he had to replace it each spring, but it's particularly aromatic, and the flowers are very showy, very bright colors, and visible to people whose vision may be getting more limited, but also very attractive to hummingbirds. But even the common ones like the cooking sage or our native salvias, which get big, give them plenty of room, they have a very classic smell. And again, you just pick a leaf as you walk by. And in the other herbs, of course, all the other herbs are fragrant to one degree or another, but some of the thymes, the little creeping thyme, but especially the little moundy ones like lemon thyme, which has again that citronella compound. So we are looking at things that are related to herbs. We're looking at things with scented foliage. If I were planting a garden like this, I would choose a couple of the bigger woody plants like the rosemary and the lavender that I mentioned. I'd put in a couple of these spiky things like the agastache, and I'd be sure to plant at least one lemon verbena right on the corner of a path so you could just grab a leaf as you walk by and then have some of these lower things nearby. If you did a plant every 3 to 4 feet and gave them all enough room to spread and clip them away from the path if you have to, but basically planting with enough room that you wouldn't have to do that kind of maintenance, then I think you'd enjoy this group of plants. And one other that I'm going to mention is the very strong smelling tagetes. Tagetes is sometimes called Mexican tarragon, Mexican marigold. Those are two different plants, but they're very, very similar. And they have a powerfully fragrant foliage, and they bloom in the wintertime. So this is a plant that gives you bright yellow flowers in the winter. It's very attractive to all kinds of beneficials. And just someone walking into the nursery with a 1 gallon container and setting it on the counter, everyone in the room can smell the foliage of this plant. It is spicy, anise type scent, powerful, powerful fragrance. There's a lot of flowers that would fit in the same category that are fragrant, like phlox and things like that. But I would focus on the plants with fragrant foliage in the sun and have a nice path that walks by them.
So there is a salvia. I believe it's called Salvia clevelandii. And by the way, you can go to the Arboretum and wander around in the Mediterranean garden area and find lots of different things and figure out what you like. But this one is, it makes spikes of flower blooms. And then when the blooms are done, you're left with these spikes and these little whorls that go up the stem. Almost every summer, when I was over at the university, I would find one of these spent flower stalks, clip it, and put it in my car. Because anytime I would go out in the sun, it would just volatilize the oils in there. And it was so energizing, I want to say.
Yeah, and these are the Salvia clevelandii is a big plant. So someone with a big yard, I have most of the native California native salvias in one place or another on my property. Salvia clevelandii, Dara's Choice, several others. Most of them spread 3 to 5 feet across easily. My Salvia clevelandii is at least 12 feet across. 4 feet tall. It's been rooting as it trails, so it's become quite a hedge where I've let it grow. You don't have to do this, folks. You can prune these things if you want to, but I choose not to. I like to see how far they'll go. And they give very showy, typically lilac to purple flowers in April, May, June, depending on the species or the cultivar. And that's it. So our native salvias here, the shrub forms of salvia that are native to different parts of California, are late spring, end of the rainfall season bloomers. I have one that continues bit into July, and that's it. And then all those southwestern salvias start coming into bloom, and that's the Greggii, Salvia microphylla, the hybrids between them that are sold as Salviagemensis. They're more compact plants. They fit into people's yards better. Hot lips is probably the best known example of those hybrids that have become very popular. And they all have aromatic foliage as well. But the native ones do have their place. And you're right, the seed head continues to have the volatile oils long after the blooms are done. And they're fascinating looking in their own way. They're kind of strange little spacey looking things. People use them in dried flower arrangements, actually. And they have a somewhat medicinal, strong, cleansing smell. And of course, the salvia that's used as burning sage for ritual purposes, Salvia apiana, grows quite well here. That's grown for the foliage. It's pungently, powerfully fragrant. That one does need careful irrigation. It's easy to overwater it, water it too often, kill it with Phytophthora. So that's one that you need to water more carefully. But once established, it's a tough and very big plant. When people are looking at our California native sages, I'm always concerned they're not going to give them enough room. These are large, substantial shrubs. And I'll tell you something else that I've learned about them on my own farm. Nothing grows through them. If they're, I can have a field of weeds and I'll have a Salvia clevelandii out there, and there's no weeds coming up through the Salvia clevelandii. I don't know whether it's just shading them out, putting chemicals in the soil allelopathically, or just out competing them, probably all of the above, but they're great for suppressing weeds. So if you have room for the California native salvias, the clevelandii being one of the biggest, but Dara's Choice, there's several others that are outstanding garden plants, and they have every part of the plant is aromatic, including, as lowest notes, the dried seed heads.
Well, sometimes Dom sends me pictures, and usually they're beautiful flowers that he's taken pictures of. And this time he sent me a picture of a teepee structure covered in bright, dark purple blue morning glories. Don, what are you doing? What are you doing? Doing morning glories? You always have bad things to say about morning glories.
I love morning glories. I absolutely, it's one of my favorite flowers, but I do caution people that morning glories can be a problem almost regardless of which kind you plant. This is a picture out in my vegetable garden right now. A customer gave me a 7 foot obelisk, metal obelisk, beautiful, very well made, very well constructed. And I looked at it and said, that needs morning glories on it. So I put it out at the edge of the garden and I planted the annual. This one's a dark blue, almost purple
That's
flowered one, and planted several seeds around the base of it back in 1st of June, roughly. And it is covered. There's probably 50, 60 blooms on it every morning. What I really like about morning glory is one, they're spectacular. They're, very, very showy flowers. And it's one of those plants which you do have to make a point of going to appreciate. It's only open in the morning. By late morning, they're already closed up. You come home at the end of the day, there's no flowers open out there. So it's one of those plants that you really kind of have to make an effort. You need to walk out to your garden before you go get in the car and go to work and look at the flowers. And that's a good thing for all of us to do. About every 10 years, I grow annual morning glories. I then spend the next 5 or 6 years pulling the seedlings out from nearby. I've forgotten about that after 2 or 3 years, and I plant them again. So this is my on year for morning glories. I do not plant the perennial one. Those of you listening out there that purchased that from me back 15, 20 years ago, sorry, don't recommend that one at all anymore. It really takes over your yard. They're beautiful, but that one can really become vegetatively invasive. It doesn't even seed. It's just doing it by runners that root. Annual morning glories are relatively easy to control, he says, laughing at himself, because the seedlings are quite recognizable. So I fully expect that next May to June, they sprout when the soil is very warm. I will be hoeing off seedlings from this year's endeavor, but they are spectacular and beautiful. Morning glories draw big Xylocopa bees in a big way. Hummingbirds are visiting the flowers. They're, quite spectacular, and they're a cool thing to have. I just want you to be aware that they can become a little locally invasive.
So questions about this? I know I was one of those people who bought that perennial
Yeah.
Morning Glory from you 20
Yeah.
years ago. Okay, so that sends out runners and
Yeah.
spreads vegetatively. Now this one, how does this, do the seeds burst and scatter themselves 3 feet around? If I put it in a half barrel with a teepee structure instead of out in the field like yours, would it stay within the barrel, you
The
think?
seeds come up nearby. I mean, they're very visible and recognizable, and they all kind of sprout at once. So it's not that hard, but there's going to be a lot of them, I can guarantee, because there's like 50 blooms open every morning right now.
Right,
They
but
don't shoot.
you're in a field,
Yeah, more
and
to the point, when I've done
you're
it in
just,
my garden, the seedlings will come up 2 or 3 feet from where you had the plant. All right, it's not
okay.
all over the yard. They don't expel or propel their seeds the way, say, oxalis does or certain other plants. Snapweed. Anybody ever grown snapweed? It's a relative of impatiens. Balsam is the other common name for it. Its seed pods burst under certain weather conditions and fling their seeds several feet. So that's a cool plant, in my opinion, but you want to be aware of that when you put it in your garden. Well, the same thing with these. They don't shoot out 10 feet across the yard, but I do guarantee I'll have a ring of seedlings around this obelisk next year, and I'll probably just hoe them out. They're very recognizable. I fully
Why
in
not let them grow up the obelisk again?
I want to reduce the seed load, so I figure this is a once every 10-year project.
Okay,
There's a
so
long list of plants that I love and grow but don't recommend, and it's definitely on there. In this picture, there's an interesting flower poking through them that is a something that I've started growing 3 or 4 years ago. Celosia, you all know Celosia, the plume flower, or the crested coxcomb, which is a really cool flower. I really like that whole group of plants. There's another type of Celosia spicata, which makes great cut flower, great everlasting. It dries well, and it's extremely easy to grow. And I planted mine first 3 or 4 years ago, and there's now about 50 of them out there. So it's reseeding itself. It's naturalizing on the edge of my vegetable garden. So it's commingling nicely with the morning glory, and I really like it. But it's one of those plants where I'm immediately seeing its reseeding potential. So like nigella, the Persian jewels, like
Love in the
larkspur.
mist.
Love in a mist. Thank you. That's the nigella. Larkspur borage has done this for me. Money plant, the Lunaria annua. These are plants that when you grow them once, it's pretty much all you ever need to do. They will reseed once you recognize the seedlings. 4 o'clock. I'm looking at some out my window. They're just closing up now. I've got them in various parts of my backyard. 4 o'clock will reseed themselves and come back as perennials. So these are the kind of naturalizing garden flowers that I just want you to be aware of when you plant them that they're going to reseed. You'll probably want to recognize the seedlings, pull them, hoe them, mulch them, whatever works in your situation. Just be aware of it when you plant them. I just want to give a little background on this next topic. This is from another nursery professional. This is someone who has a nursery that had a very active social media presence and also a really good website and got a lot of hits on their website and was very active on Facebook and so forth. And that's all declining. Unless you pay a lot of money, your results from that input are really declining rapidly at this point.
So, in the past year, this person writes, I've been engrossed in trying to figure out why my website, once high ranked on Google, has become almost impossible to find. Here's something I've learned, and everyone should realize for their own health and safety. The web as we knew it is gone. No matter the subject, food, medicine, gardening, the results of almost all web searches are dominated by companies who pay a lot and by big institutions. A recent AI search has made it much worse. It means the info you get isn't necessarily accurate or authentic, but is basically a commercial. Beware. Scour and vet your results because it's only going to get worse. It makes it very difficult for me as a small nursery and as an independent writer and publisher. We're constantly looking for ways to sort of hack the systems. And on top of all that, we miss the days of searching and finding similar-minded folks, great blogs based on experience and real connections.
The problem is that in the field of horticulture, Google searches have been problematic for a while. Artificial intelligence and the other aspects that you're all reading about now are just searching through what's out there and amalgamating it into a narrative form and giving it to you. That means that they're pulling up information that could be as much as 50 to 75% inaccurate off the top of my head and putting it in narrative format, and you're reading it. And it sounds plausible because it's now in a narrative format. What's missing from all of this is editors who will look at it and go, "Oh, can you prove that sentence? Can you tell me exactly the basis for your assertion that calcium is the cause of blossom end rot?" No, it'll just put it in front of you, and it's becoming worse. Every couple of days now, we're dealing with people who say, "Well, I did some research, or I looked it up, and this is what it told me." Well, what's it? Also, of course, when you do a Google search for a particular plant, trying to get information, the first two or three pages are going to be commercial links, they're advertisements, or fake links, basically websites that are AI generated or something that have, make a lot of money by having ad links on the side. And the content is sometimes hilariously wrong, but what concerns me is there's a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily know that. The best example I came up with recently, looking up a particular disease in orchard settings and clean orchard floor, orchard cleanliness is a very important part of managing certain diseases and pests. They call, you want bare orchard floor. So that caused the search thing amalgamator to go into a thing about how it's important to change the filters in my vacuum cleaner.
So you could have a clean floor, of
So I could
course.
vacuum the orchard, I guess. I'm not sure. But this is the kind of stuff we're seeing. And the misinformation is rampant, absolutely rampant in the field of horticulture. We all know that. So it's very frustrating. And I would urge you at this point, because it's going to get worse, not better. I urge you to find .edu sites and bookmark them. I would suggest if you're looking up plants, go straight to Wikipedia. Go buy all those other sites until you find ones that are actually legit. And it's really hard to tell the legitimate sites at this point in many cases, but .edu sites are still safe. And in many cases, .gov sites are still good information. But in particular, look for academic results and start bookmarking those sites. Because Google search, I did one on a topic recently, and three pages of results, they were all either ads or basically fake sites, and the information was all over the place. And it's very hard for someone who hasn't trained in horticulture to know what's correct information, what isn't. We were having a lot of fun 2, 3 years ago when they started coming out with all the new plants that we could order online. They were like elephant ear that's bigger than your house with red and white striped leaves, obviously fake. Anyone in the nursery industry, anybody in the hort with any hort training at all would look at these and go, "There's no hosta that's 6 feet tall. There's no elephant ear that's that big. That color doesn't exist in roses. We know that." But these companies would be out there. They'd be selling plants, selling seed. And you look at them, try to figure out who they are. There's no, it's not a legit organization. So these, that was an amusing thing 2 or 3 years ago. Now we're getting to the point where misinformation is spreading faster and in a more organized format than it used to. I recommend you find experts. I recommend you use cooperative extension, get to know the master gardeners, find that nursery locally where they know the answers, and bookmark those .edu sites at this point. That's really the best advice I can give you. And I will say this, if you're interested in plant taxonomy, where plants are from, Wikipedia is very accurate with respect to what the plant is, what the current taxonomy is, and all that kind of thing. Now, many of the plants there aren't, they're not going to give you cultivation information, but I have found Wikipedia to be one of the most useful sites for that, for the general information about a plant. Your public service announcement today is ignore everything on the internet.
So, Don, I didn't ask you my weekly questions yet. Is there
Okay.
anything this week that you would like to tell us about what you're planting or harvesting or doing or whatever?
Well, September is melon month on our farm. All those melons that I planted back in June and all the way into maybe the end of June are beginning to ripen now. And now we're trying to figure out how to tell when a watermelon is ripe. So far, the first one, I used my calendar method, which is where I take a picture of the label and I write it on my calendar. It says 80 days I go out. 80 days on my calendar, watermelon ripe? Question mark. Well, you know what? It was cool in July. We had 20 days below average in July, and it wasn't ripe then, so that was a waste, unfortunately. So I thought, well, I better wait another 10 to 14 days for this other one on the same vine. Yeah, that was overripe. So I still haven't got the when is the watermelon ripe thing down yet. But in general, in the past, with normal to average weather, marking my calendar has worked very well. This is one of the reasons muskmelons are so popular. You just walk out, you tug on it. If it's ripe, it detaches. Okay, you know it's ripe, take it in and enjoy it. A little harder to tell with honeydews. They change color, but they also lose their gloss. So that's part of it with them. But watermelons, I thought I had this figured out after 4 decades plus of this. Thump it, yeah, thump it until it sounds hollow. They all sound hollow. This all presumes some prior knowledge. Let's put it that way. This is one of the reasons when it spring is here and people are buying vegetables and they want to grow watermelon, and I don't want to talk them out of it because it is fun to do, and they've usually got kids with them. And I say, just keep your expectations low. They take a lot of space. This is real important. Each watermelon plant, each mound that I have with two or three plants on it, takes a full 6 foot diameter circle of foliage. It runs past that, but that's what it absolutely needs. Uncrowded, nothing, no other melons nearby shading it, no weeds in there, no nothing. And it's a low growing foliage, so it hugs the ground. So you got to make sure there's nothing competing with the watermelon. We only get one or two per plant. And then the other tricky part is figuring out when they're ripe. So if you got plenty of space, it's fun to do. If you're limited for space, well, grow sugar baby and maybe you'll get one or two.
So, is there? I was thinking that maybe a really small melon would put more melons on the same plant rather than just having one great big one. Because if you misjudge the one great big one, well, that's a waste. They don't ripen after you pick them. But if you had a bunch of them, then you could try one, and if it wasn't quite ripe, you could wait and try again.
The single serving melons are actually a thing now. And I'm going to do, you know what? Next year, I'm definitely going to grow some of those and see if I get better results. I think they're a great idea. The Charente muskmelon is an example. The thing is the size of a softball and it ripens, and it's easy to tell when it ripens because, like other muskmelons, it tugs right off when it does. But even if you get it wrong, there's a bunch more on there. I really think smaller melons are the way to go. I will tell you, it is fun to grow a 35-pound watermelon, as I did one year. Plant was 12-foot diameter. And eating a 35-pound watermelon, you'd better have a party or a bunch of people over. September is melon month on my farm. So I want to follow up on a note we got a few weeks back. And we don't always get to your questions or comments as quickly as we'd like to. And this is from Holly in Southern California. And is having problems with tomatoes. And a few weeks back, it looked like verticillium wilt and wanted my opinion. I would say, just for the record, from your pictures, yeah, it sure looks like verticillium wilt. The question was about water stress and all that kind of thing. But actually, I would like you to do is now, if they're still in the ground, take a couple more pictures if you can and send them on to davisgardenshow@gmail.com. And we'll go ahead and talk about what happened, where that verticillium wilt might have come from, how to manage verticillium wilt in the future. So a little bit of homework there, Holly. We appreciate your patience. And if you could send us a couple more pictures, if they're still in the ground. If they're not, that's also useful information. So appreciate that if you could do that for us.
Well, I'm going to have a garden quote for you, Don, but I want to let you know that I went and I used AI today. There's one called Claude, Claude dot AI. Yeah, I found a bunch. So here we go. Money can't buy happiness, but it can buy plants, which for a gardener is the same thing.
We had a saying in our house when I would say money doesn't grow on trees, my kids would turn to look at me and say, "In your case, it does." You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.